Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can, because achieving your success is how Bloom Shapiro measures theirs. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin, along with John Krofcik. And John, we have a return guest today.
We do.
Yes. And he was so good last time, we wanted to do some more. His name is David Daly. And what was really interesting is that he actually had some of his in-laws, I believe, lived in our town.
Oh, so I remember him now.
Yeah, remember. He was supposed to come
down.
Didn't
he get a flat tire or something?
Exactly. He was supposed to come and visit with us. And we never got the opportunity, and I've never been with him in person, but we were doing it over the phone again. But a very interesting guy who works for fairvote.org, and we've had them on many times talking about the electoral process. And his first book basically explained that in 2010, the Republicans really got a leg up on the Democrats by virtue of Operation Red Map. And we go back into that in this conversation because you have to understand what happened in 2010 to begin to understand what the Democrats and others have been trying to push back against as it relates to gerrymandering and the like. And the new book that David has put out is called Unrigged: How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy, John.
Well, I hope so. I'm very confused because, the people, the person we have in the White House now obviously isn't a leader, and I'm very disappointed with that. But the people that the Democrats put up are, you know, they have a socialist agenda, which concerns me. So I don't know what to do.
I think you have a few months to go, and you have to really weigh all the considerations. But I think most importantly for this conversation, we're really not talking about policy per se. We're talking about making the process fair.
All right. And making what we do need, fair process.
Because,
look
what happened in Pennsylvania as an example, John, where the Democrats won the bulk of votes for Congress. But because of gerrymandering, the way votes were put into different districts, they were behind, and I forgot the numbers, so pardon me, but something like a delegation of, 16-3 or something ridiculous. Republicans were outweighing the Democrats, even though the popular vote had gone the other way. Now you say, that doesn't sound possible. Well, if you put all the urban votes together and somebody wins by 90%, and then you carve around districts where somebody wins by 51-49.
Well, our state is just like that.
Well,
basically,
our state, when you look at it, our whole delegation is Democratic. And it's not necessarily that the Democrats have controlled the process. It's just that...
the districts are laid out are...
Well, the one district in Connecticut that is perhaps questionable is the... No, I'm trying to think. The first. The first looks like a salamander. The fifth is very competitive. We don't live in the fifth, but there's a lot of activity around the fifth.
We used to be in the fifth.
Right. We used to be in the fifth.
Out.
Now we take the fifth. But here in Pennsylvania, they had a court case recently, and there have been a lot of court cases about what happened back in 2010. And what the Supreme Court, I believe it was, of the state of Pennsylvania decided was that they had to redistrict. And when they did that for 2018, where the Democrats won big overall, now they have a delegation of 9-9. So, and that's more akin to the way the state is.
How can we, does he talk about how we can fix this so that, can we have an independent You know, how do we get a hold of this?
Well, we do talk about that.
Have a fair election.
I believe we talk about it because I did this interview about a month and a half ago.
Okay.
I believe we do talk about that, but we also talk about it in the context of many other conversations that we have on this podcast.
Right.
But he's talking here primarily about a lot of citizens groups saying this cannot stand. We've got to be fairer in the way we're apportioning votes. And we've got to encourage people to go out and vote.
Right.
And we've got to make this process one that we can be proud of, whatever the results are that we think, all of us, left, right, and center,
I agree.
Is a lot fairer.
I think it doesn't matter. The results will be, as long as the results are fair, you know, whatever comes out, comes
right.
out.
I mean, so we talk about these grassroots groups that have gotten together, John.
All right.
But we do a lot of history here, too, because you really have to understand this. With this very important election coming up, I think people want to understand what is the state of play as it relates to the electoral process in America, particularly for Congress and for the Senate. And I've said it many times on this podcast. It's almost shocking that the Democrats were able to take back the House, given the amount of gerrymandering. Now the Democrats, aside from the grassroots efforts, and I guess you could call them to some degree grassroots, but they're led by people like the former Attorney General and Stacey Abrams. They're really fighting back the Democrats, saying, okay, we understood what you did back then, and
right.
congratulations, you had a better data operation, you knew how to take control of state legislatures, but we have caught up. And we're not going to let that happen again. So you really have at least both parties saying, I'm going to watch you, you're going to watch me. And then you've got these grassroots groups growing right up the middle saying, we're watching both of you,
yeah.
and we want this process to work.
We need that independent.
Yeah.
We need somehow to bring fairness back to our electoral, you know, to the...
But by the way, I do another podcast, John, that we will be posting later, and we talk about these independent commissions in greater detail than we might in this particular one. But what's really interesting is, what's independent? Who's independent?
Well, exactly. Everybody comes to the table with a bias.
Right. I mean, if you get three judges... They're not necessarily fully independent. You also have different mechanisms by which you give it back to the legislature at different points. They set up a committee, and that committee may have four members of this party, four members of that party, but the chairman is of one party, so now they can skew it, or the governor gets involved.
I
mean, there's
difficult.
Lots of ways.
It's so difficult.
It's very difficult. But these independent commissions are coming more into focus, I believe, in California and other places, where they're really trying to set it aside away from the political process.
Well, I'm anxious to hear this.
Oh, it's really good. And by the way, how many times have I said they like to select us, the voters, before we get to select
exactly.
them? And it should be the other way around.
They work for us.
Right. Well, presumably. David Daley, Unrigged, here on America Trends.
With me on the line on America Trends is David Daley. He's written a new book called Unrigged. But in order to really give you the context of what we're going to be discussing in this podcast, David, we need to go back to your last book and its unmentionable title. It's Rat Effed. And it's a fascinating book about certain practices that were undertaken some years back that ensured a majority of support for a minority of candidates over time. Lots of ways that the election system can be contorted to someone's will. And so let's place in context the story of how Americans are battling back to save democracy, as you say, in the subtitle to your book. But to do that, let's go back to the previous book, how we needed to save democracy in the first place.
Let me start with what I think is a really disturbing statistic. There are 59 million Americans that live in a state where one or both chambers of their state legislature are controlled by the party that won fewer votes in 2018. 59 million of us, that's almost one in five. And that is because of partisan gerrymandering. Gerrymandering is the act of drawing congressional and legislative districts to benefit the side that holds the pens. And we are really the only country, the only modern democracy that allows our politicians to draw these districts and choose their own voters. And our modern problems with this really, now, gerrymandering is one of the oldest tricks in the book, right? I mean, mm-hmm. you can trace it back to, you know, Patrick Henry trying to, you know, keep James Madison out of the very first Congress, and it takes its name from the Massachusetts governor in 1812 who draws these crazy-looking districts for the state senate around Boston.
Yeah, like a salamander.
Thinks they look like a salamander. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, politicians are always looking for an angle and a way to keep themselves in power. In 2008, the Democrats sweep Washington. They take a supermajority in the Senate. Barack Obama is elected president. They hold on to the House. And everybody's looking at the demographics of the country, and even the smartest Republican minds are saying, boy, we've got a problem here. What they hit on as a solution was realizing that as tough a year as 2008 was for them, 2010 represented a possibility because the party that's on the out usually does pretty good in the midterms coming up, and the midterms in 2010 weren't just any old midterms. They were a census year midterm. The year that ended in zero. So, you know, like now, we're going through a census, and after the census, we redraw all of these districts for another 10 years. And a handful of really sophisticated Republican strategists said, oh, we could try to win control of the redistricting process in all of these key states, in North Carolina, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Florida, Pennsylvania, and then draw ourselves maps using this brand new map making technology, using all of the big data that had become available over the course of the previous decade that just wasn't there before for map makers. And we could draw ourselves a decade worth of power. They were able to do this really cheaply. It only cost them $30 million because you're trying to win a bunch of state legislative seats in the middle of nowhere. You know, the cost of that is next to nothing. It was really a money ball of politics, and it worked brilliantly, and it helped define what our politics have looked like for the last decade.
Now, let me just go back, because there really hasn't, or has there, been a golden age of voting rights. We had the Act in 1965, but when you look at the many roadblocks, impediments that we've set up to voting from, as you say, time immemorial, poll taxes, literacy tests, caging of votes, ballot stuffing, I mean, have we really ever had a moment in American history where we can say, boy, we've got a real level playing field and we're really trying to get everybody registered and voting? Has that ever been the case?
A depressing question, because I think you're right. I'm not sure it has ever been the case. And I think we like to think of the path of voting rights in this country being, you know, a straight line towards progress. You know, we weren't founded in a state of perfection, but we have worked hard to do a better job and expand the vote over the years. And the reality is something quite different. You know, the reality is that voting rights in this country has always been, you know, something that's come in zigs and zags. It has always been a weapon of sorts that has been used to keep people from the polls. That there have been moments of, you know, wonderful expansions of voting rights that can be followed by very dark periods of retrenchment. If voting rights had been a straight line in this country, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution, you know, back in the 1860s and 70s, it would have solved a lot of this, right? But they didn't. You know, the Jim Crow era follows all of, you know, the passage of those, you know, expansive, wonderful amendments. And states found very cruel ways around them. And what I think we don't realize often enough is that a lot of the cruel vestiges of that era are still written into state law around the country, and they still affect who gets to vote even today. Those constitutional amendments weren't enough. The Voting Rights Act wasn't enough. Nothing has completely sort of kept the vote away from being, deeply contested and problematic.
Now, over the years, I think if we have looked at an equalizer in this process, we've turned to the federal government or to the courts. And in your book, of course, you talk about citizens taking back their democracy in different ways, in different places, very uplifting stories. But are they the institutional, issues or impediments that we need to overcome? In other words, if in fact the U.S. Supreme Court, as you point out as well in your book, is basically saying we're not getting involved in these longer, and if the federal government can't really pass any more constitutional amendments, we haven't had a substantive one in a very long time, and there's no energy, it doesn't seem, to really deal with it on the federal level, though I know the House did pass a major package of reforms that lie dormant today, waiting for the Senate to address them. Really, where do we turn if not to these patriots and these people in far-flung places trying to do it? But is that enough against the institutional roadblocks?
Some of the most profound questions of our time. Let me try to unpack it as best I can. The federal government appears gridlocked at this moment, and there are forces within the parties that would rather use voting rights as a partisan weapon than an expansive tool to be sure that every voice is heard. The federal courts especially have become very unfriendly for voting rights. We saw what happened in the courts on partisan gerrymandering back in the 2019 session, where they essentially closed the door to the federal courts to these claims. They called them non-justiciable. That follows the decision in Shelby County versus Holder that essentially, gutted the key enforcement mechanisms of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act and opened the door to all kinds of new voting restrictions, especially across the South and in states that had to prove to the Justice Department previously, because they'd had a record of prejudice there, that any changes to voting did not, make it harder for folks to vote. And then I think the other piece of this is that the gerrymanders in 2010 put state governments beyond the reach of citizens. So those 59 million Americans who live in states where the party with fewer votes still controls state government, how do you replace a government that is no longer representative of the people, but which has locked itself into power even with fewer votes? And there's been a real epidemic of minority rule this decade because of those gerrymanders. If you can't get action from the feds, if you can't get action in the courts, and if you can't do anything at the ballot box to kick out your own representatives when you feel like they no longer represent you, what do you do? What I found across the country in 2018, as I set off to write this book, was this incredible spirit that people realized they had to take this task on themselves. And if they wanted to, Dr. Martin Luther King talks of the moral arc of the universe being long but bending toward justice, and these folks realize that arc don't pull itself. It doesn't bend towards justice on its own. It only bends when everybody goes out and kind of grabs it and pulls it and kind of yanks it in the direction of justice. And so they fought for voting rights. They fought for redistricting. reform. They fought for, you know, structural changes like ranked choice voting. They fought to make it easier to register to vote. They fought for things like Medicaid expansion in states that were unwilling to even consider it, even though it was popular, even though it was a return of Obamacare dollars that were already leaving the state and going to the feds. And they won. They won big, and they won everywhere with these amazing coalitions of Democrats, Republicans, Independents. And I think they showed that we're not as polarized a country as folks want us to think we are. All of these ambitious, important reforms won with 60, 70% of the vote.
And I think you said that there were 15 of 16 statewide initiatives that ultimately did win out, and these were to expand various rights in one way or another. And yet you do tell us that we still have all of this powerful pushback, because you said that in 2018 alone, 24 states introduced 70 proposals to make voting more difficult. And I'm sure that groups like ALEC and these model bills floating everywhere are throughout the land and still trying that pushback. And we still have some of these minority-controlled legislatures. So are those particular efforts finding success, or are they being blunted in these legislatures at the moment, or are they finding, you know, creative ways, the majority who are in the minority, to block them?
A little bit of everything. You're absolutely right. I mean, a lot of these resounding victories in 2018 were then rolled back by gerrymandered legislatures representing a minority of the people, which on one hand is profoundly depressing. On the other hand is sort of the story of the nation, right? We were just talking about how all of this progress zigs and zags. It's not a straight line. So just like the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments, the Voting Rights Act, we're not the end of the story. Winning 15 of 16 of these important fights in 2018 is also not the end of the story. And I think what we need to remember in our time that I think we sometimes forget is that progress is not measured by success in any one election. Progress is measured in staying in the fight. And if activists want to make a better country, they're not able to ever leave the playing field. You're not ever able to say, we succeeded, we're done, and now we can go home. Because there are forces that, you know, disagree, that are trying to pull that arc of the universe in another direction, and they're leaving their hands on that arc. So it's a tug of war. And as soon as you take your hands off and think that you have won, the other side is going to pull you into the river.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes us different. Our partners are true business advisors, listening, analyzing, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can, anticipating your future goals and drafting plans to make sure you get there. Because at Bloom Shapiro, achieving your success and satisfaction is how we measure ours. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
David Daly is with us on America Trends. The book is called Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. It seemed almost inconceivable to me that in 2018, the Democrats would be able to take back the House of Representatives because of what happened in 2010. And it took, I think, about an 8% plurality overall across the nation to do that. So they needed some extra votes. But with that said, how much can you attribute to these grassroots efforts, the result that occurred in 2018? Or was it just a super backlash? Often in these off-election years, the party in power, the president in power, does lose seats. But tell us what you saw in action in 2018.
I think it was a huge part of it. And I think one of the things that people, I think, fail to sometimes fully appreciate is they'll say, well, Democrats took back the House in 2018. Maybe those districts weren't, you know, as gerrymandered as Daley and other people say they were. And first, you're absolutely right. It required this monumental 8 or 9 point swing in the vote in order to make that happen. But it also required new maps in states like Pennsylvania, in Virginia, and in Florida, states where activists brought incredibly complex and expensive litigation trying to fight these maps in state courts as being unconstitutional partisan gerrymanders, or in federal courts as being unconstitutional racial gerrymanders. And they won. And they got new maps in Pennsylvania and in parts of Florida and Virginia. So if you count the, you know, 18 seats in Pennsylvania that had to be redrawn, if you look at the seats in Florida and Virginia, you're probably looking at 23, 24 seats that where maps had to be made fairer. And that was won by citizens. It was won by public interest lawyers.
And you don't hear about that very often as a part of the equation of what happened in 2018. Is this the most far-reaching part of this? Meaning, I know North Carolina, I believe some of their districts were overturned. You talk about Michigan in the book. Is this whole notion of getting one person, one vote back into some sense of normalcy in the gerrymandering process? Because, and you explained it to me when we talked in the past, that in many ways what they did was they were able to put all a huge chunk of Democratic voters in one district, and so somebody could win it 95-5, and then build all these other districts where 51-49 would suffice for the Republican candidates. So tell us what kind of reformation happened in some of those states, and was it because courts did get involved and citizens in combination, and did they then turn it over to independent commissions as opposed to partisan ones?
You saw a little bit of everything. So take Pennsylvania, for example, where Republicans were able to hold a 13-5 advantage in Pennsylvania this entire decade, ever since they took over and drew these maps. And you can say a lot of things about Pennsylvania, but it's not a 13-5 Republican state. It's slightly bluish, I'd say. You know, before 2016, it had gone for the Democratic presidential candidate every year since 88. U.S. Senate seats have been largely split between parties. They probably had more Democratic governors than Republican over the last 25 years. So I think it's a, you know, I think you would call it a purple state that leans blue. Democrats would consistently win about 100,000 more statewide votes for U.S. Congress, but Republicans were holding on to 13 of the 18 seats. So Democrats would win more than 50% of the vote, but they'd get fewer than 30% of the seats. Citizens brought this amazing lawsuit, and they challenged this map as unconstitutional in state court. They told this amazing story by marshaling together these political scientists who kind of talked about the state's political geography, and these brilliant mathematicians who showed exactly, who kind of took the map apart and showed how it could not have been more biased even if they tried. And they ran like 3 billion different permutations, and they found that the map that the partisans enacted was more biased than, you know, 3 billion other neutral maps. The court threw it out. They gave it back to the legislature to try again. And when the legislature came up with another biased map, they handed it off to a special master, you know, an independent neutral academic, in this case, a Stanford professor. And he came back and drew a map that in 2018 returned a 9-9 delegation, which is about what you would imagine, right? You know, so other states have gone to commissions. You know, some states have given this over to a nonpartisan state demographer. So there's a lot of different ways that this can be done. I think what you always see is that you get fairer maps when both parties are in the rooms, and you get even better maps when the foxes are not the ones who are designing the security system in the hen house.
Now, you also talk about, to be fair to the other side of the coin, at times we hear about voter fraud as opposed to voter suppression, which is primarily what we've been talking about, or at least mitigating the impact of voters' ability to really fairly be represented. Tell us what happened, because President Trump said there was a lot of voter fraud. And, of course, he wanted to dismiss the 3 million vote plurality that Hillary Clinton had. And that dissipated. It ultimately evaporated. Wasn't it Kris Kobach who was involved with that? And there's a story about him in your book. Explain what happened there.
Kobach is this amazing character in modern American politics. He has really made his name by talking about voter fraud and voter ID and suggesting that there's a huge problem with folks who are not supposed to be voting or voting multiple times, or voter rolls that are not up to date that introduce the potential for fraud. And he's been able to gain a foothold in our politics, even though there's no academic or kind of real world evidence for what he's talking about. There's an amazing academic survey of every vote that's cast in the nation between 2000 and 2012 that a professor named Justin Levitt, a law professor in California, did. And what he found is that there were 34 votes out of the hundreds of millions, if not billions, of votes that were cast in that entire period of time that you could say had been intentionally fraudulently cast. 34 votes out of
34.
All of those 34. So we don't really have the voter fraud problem that Kris Kobach says we have, despite the fact that it kind of gets all of this attention in the media. What we do have, however, are all of these voter ID laws and similar that are designed to prevent a problem that we don't really have, but that then in turn create these new barriers, and they often create new barriers for precisely people who Kobach is less interested in having vote. It's amazing, days after Trump is elected, he has Kobach up to Bedminster, his golf club in New Jersey, and they have their arms around each other at a press conference outside. Kobach is escorted in, and he's made the co-chairman of this very important commission with the vice president that is going to look into voter fraud, and he's convinced the new president that he might have won the popular vote and had it stolen from him. It was buses of people from Massachusetts going up to New Hampshire, 2.8 million of them, I guess, and casting fraudulent ballots, which simply didn't happen. And this commission really had as its goal the creation of some kind of a national voter ID system. So again, a solution to a problem we don't have that introduces very real problems we don't want. They establish this commission and attempt to hold hearings, and they have all of these kind of academics whose credentials are a little murky, who are testifying, and clearly, a goal of this national voter ID, except the presidential commission isn't allowed to work that way. A presidential commission has got to be bipartisan. It's got to involve everybody who is on the panel. And they had put the Democratic Secretary of State in Maine on the panel, I think perhaps thinking he was going to be sort of a patsy or just kind of this, small state guy who they could run over. And instead, he sort of knew the rules of this commission better than Kobach did. And when Kobach didn't play by the rules, when he didn't let everybody know what was happening, when he didn't, send agendas around. And this Humane Secretary of State, his name is Matt Dunlop, is able to sort of file the lawsuits that grind the commission down to a halt. He uncovers all of these emails and all of this evidence from Kobach and Pence's office that sort of speak to exactly what they were trying to do, to exactly how secretive this was going to be, to how they were going to, you know, vacuum all of this information up from secretaries of state around the country and use it for their own purposes, you know, all of it, you know, wildly not allowed. And rather than continue the commission, the White House, in the middle of all of this, simply pulls the plug on it. So I think we can really thank, you know, Matt Dunlop up in Maine for providing a real national service.
Now, as we look at where we are today, we've had this coronavirus terrible situation that's been plaguing not only the United States but the world, and this is throwing the whole election process into something of a lather, and we're trying to figure out what we do in terms of potential mail-in votes. I think we've only got about 6 states now that do this out west, and we do have absentee ballots for reason and all of that. But if we go to a mail-in system, the president was quoted in an interview that I heard the other day as saying that he thought Republicans could never win with a mail-in system. And so I know that there was an attempt to put some money behind a mail-in mechanism that would go, I guess, to the states to help implement it, but that was taken out of one of the stimulus bills. Where do you think we stand as a nation on the precipice of the 2020 election?
We have to be really, really careful that a dramatic public health crisis does not lead to a constitutional crisis in the fall. And we have to be thinking right now, with the 200 days we have left, about how we safeguard the presidential election. If you take a look at these primaries that are happening around the country right now, or that have been postponed, and think of it as kind of a dry run for November, we're not doing very well, right? You look at Ohio, the governor of Ohio postponed that primary the afternoon before it was set to take place. Overnight, the courts in Ohio wouldn't let him do that. So the governor, along with his public health director, stepped in and shut it down another way. Can you imagine if that was happening in the first week of November and elections are being shut down the day before they're taking place? If you look at what's happening in Wisconsin right now, it is chaos. You've got 111 counties that are saying they don't have any poll workers at all. You've got the state trying to buy 1.5 million pens so that nobody has to share a pen. They're trying to get 1.5 million hand wipes as well, and they're not even able to get all of those. We've got to be able to step back from the partisan nature of this and guarantee that everybody who wants to vote can vote without feeling like they're going to risk their health to do so, and that we can have poll workers who are often senior citizens or retirees who feel like mm-hmm. they can do their job without also getting sick. And this is going to be a problem in a purple state like Wisconsin. It's going to be a problem in a blue state like New York. And it's going to be a problem in a red state with seniors like Florida. It's going to be a problem everywhere. So we've got to find a solution together that solves it. And there are a lot of things we can do to make voting easier. More voting at home, more voting by mail, really thinking through the kind of in-person voting we have. So, because, I mean, imagine the lines we would have if everybody in line has to stand 6 feet apart.
I know. But David, thinking about 50 administrative arms having to get their arms around all of this change is just, it's breathtaking.
It's huge to think what we have to do. Ballots that have to be printed and translated and laws that have to be changed to allow election administrators to open these ballots a couple of days before so they can start counting. Do you have to request an absentee ballot or is one sent to you automatically? All of this has to be paid for. Optical scanners have to be purchased. Poll workers have to be retrained. The media has to be educated because it's going to take more time to count these votes in places like Pennsylvania and Michigan. So they can't be calling a winner on election night, but then telling you it's somebody else is ahead in the morning, because then people are going to start, crying voter fraud. There's a lot of work that has to be done. We've got 200 days left to do it. We better get started.
Let me ask you in closing, there are so many other aspects to this book and so many stories that David relates that I encourage you really to go out and get Unrigged. But here we are, and we've got a big issue related to the presidential and Senate and House races coming up. But we also have the census going on at the same time. And seeing how impactful what happened in 2010 was for almost the next 10 years, what about Census 2020? Because there are a lot of people who have a lot more on their mind than responding to the census. There has been an attempt to, of course, add a citizenship piece to that. That failed. There's been an attempt to only count those people who are old enough to vote in the census as opposed to all people who reside in a particular county or municipality. So tell us, what should we be looking for as it relates to Census 2020 affecting voting rights going forward?
Response rates are way down, and it's going to be hard for all of these census workers to go out door to door and complete their work. They're going to need more time. They're going to need more money. It's going to be a tougher and more dangerous path. Imagine all the college kids who folks thought they were going to be counted in one place, and now they're living in their parents' basement again. There is a lot of new challenges have been thrown in front of the census, which is crucial for the formula that sets up trillions of dollars of federal funding. It is crucial for the apportionment of the House of Representatives, the number of seats each state gets in Congress, and then it's used to draw up those individual lines the following year. So there is an awful lot at stake, and this is yet one more perfect storm in the middle of this pandemic. We have this crucial decennial count going on, and it is going to be transformed like so many other things in American life. We're really in uncharted waters right now, Larry.
David Daly, we'll leave on that note, a very serious one, but I think appropriate to the moment. Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. I thank you for being with us today on America Trends.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers 40 years of experience in industries from manufacturing to professional services to nonprofits.